Welcome to On the Edge with April Mahoney Brains. Here, this is the spot where the conversation is pointed, the guests are sharp, and the responses are never dull. Welcome home, brains. There's only one requirement to hang out on the edge, is that you open your big brain and close your small mind. Did you bring your thinking caps? It's time to put them on, because the conversation starts
She said full and absolute. I love it. I love it. Brains, we are at the spot right here on the edge, the place where the conversation is pointed and the guests are sharp and the responses are never dull. We have Annetta Mallon from Australia. She is a grief recovery specialist and a whole lot more. I just can't, brains, I have to bring it to y'all's attention that silver hair is doing it to me. She said that it's genetic, but it's something about growing into ourselves, whatever that is. If that's our size, if that's our hair color, if it's a relationship, or if it's grief, because that's something that you have to mature into. Grief is a process, brains. It is not an automatic, and everybody's not going to handle it the same way. It's tools to help you get through it. You'll never get over it. I just lost my mother. And I'm bent, but I'm not broken. And I want to talk to Annetta about that and what it's like in Australia, because what people tell me, I don't know, it's different. But here in the United States and the African American community, we have a celebration of life. I mean, we have a party. We really celebrate how that person lived, but you got to think about when you die, how you lived. So there's a lot of components to that, and how we're going to share that with children. So tell us, Annetta, start with your story, and then how did you find this particular genre and group of individuals to support?
That's a really interesting question. Thank you. The way you describe grief, I matured into this work, and it's something that for me has been evolving for most of my life. So a very long time ago, back in the 90s, I was actually a birth doula once in San Diego for a lovely young couple, and it is an extraordinary energy when someone comes into the world. And I was honored that they asked me, and I'm really pleased that I did it. But that determined that for me, I was not interested in pursuing anything more to do with birth. And then I lived my life and lived in a few different countries and then came back to live in Australia. And we'd immigrated when I was very young. And I went back to university and stayed at university because I'm a collector and got 4 degrees, because why not while you're in the groove? And my studies began to focus within the general field of sociology and social science, back to health sociology and all the unspoken stuff around death and the intersections of sex and death, because we don't talk about what happens when end of life takes years and your sexual needs change and you remain a sensual person.
Oh my God, you die? I'm sorry, your sex dies too? Oh, girl, just take me now, then take me now.
That's not my plan. I'll have to get back to you on that because I'm still on this side. And I have been a specialist grief and loss trauma recovery psychotherapist for over 30 years. So my studies into end of life and the processes of supporting people and why don't we talk about this? I'm fascinated by the stuff we don't talk about because I immediately want to talk about it a lot, loudly to everyone.
I mean, you know, it's death and taxes. It's guaranteed.
That's right.
And
that's right.
It is. But you know what? It's an evolution. Now, again, I don't know how deep you go into it, but I believe I'm a very religious person. I believe in my religious doctrine, but I also am very spiritual and metaphysical. It all has a place in my life. And I know, I can taste it on my tongue that there is something after this. And I do believe that it's greater. I do believe in epigenetics, intergenerational trauma. I do believe in past lives. I've had a past life experience. That's just me, brains. Now, however you roll, that's on you. I'm not trying to convince you to do anything. But how you live can sure be indicative of how you die. Are there secrets that you kept?
I absolutely agree.
Yeah, are there secrets that you kept? Are there questions that you didn't answer? Did you do a deed? Do you have a lot of guilt? You know, are you scared? Because I talked to my mother before she was dying. Mm-hmm. And I said, Mama, I said, how was it being 90? She said, it's the pits. I said, well, you know, how long do you want to live? She said, well, baby, what if I lived forever? Wouldn't that be horrible? What if I were not able to see what is on the other side? And because of religious doctrines, you know, some people think that there's no reincarnation. Some religions believe that, you know, the end is the end. You know, I just, my mind just cannot conceive that. I'm not that small of a thinker. I think that there's other possibilities.
There's many, many choices. If you don't mind me asking, is your religion a Christian one?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Did you know that reincarnation was removed from the Bible at the Council of Nicaea in 550 CE? So it was easier to control people from the perspective of the church. So the idea that reincarnation is still very, very important to people of many different belief systems and faiths and spiritual perspectives doesn't surprise me, because the idea has been around for a really long time.
Well, I chuckle because I had some dear friends of mine when I was going to China. And we went, and I had to get a visa, and we were talking about, you know, you can't proselytize, you can't talk about religion, can't take Bibles in and all that. Yep. And so I asked my friend's mother, and I said, well, you know, I believe in reincarnation. I'm going there because of a spiritual awakening. And she goes, oh, I don't believe in reincarnation. I said, but you're quick to say that you're a born again Christian. You know. I just pumped her brakes, and she scratched her head, and she was like, oh yeah, so there's a rebirthing there. However you want to frame it, you know, I'm not going to argue with you, however you want to frame it, but I know that this can't be the end. I saw my mother's soul, I kid you not, separate from her body. I put my chest on her chest and felt her very last heartbeat.
How extraordinary. What a gift.
Yeah, it was a gift. I gave her permission to leave. She gave me permission to stay. But Annetta, everyone's not going to have that. You know, there's a lot of trauma that people have experienced. There's hatred. There's greed. There's shame. They don't know
who
their parents are.
There's a lot of anger. There's a lot of anger. And let me be generally honest. Most deaths are peaceful, which is wonderful. But if someone is really, really angry, ragingly angry, and has been that way all of their life, their actual work of death, work of dying, may be very hard to witness for people close to them, because they may well fight to the very last possible moment. Mm-hmm. So there's a fear there. Doesn't mean it's easy to be around. Oh, yes. Underneath all anger is horrifying fear. Absolutely.
Well, okay. So now let's talk about the perspective of sharing this information with children. I like to ask grief recovery specialists and psychologists and therapists about that, because you can't keep telling little Bobby that Grandpa's just sleeping in that casket. He's going to be afraid to go to sleep.
Absolutely. Thank you for expressing that so beautifully. I often get asked this question, and it's funny for me because I'm child-free by choice. And because I'm very clear that I never wanted children, I'm a great person to communicate with them, mm-hmm. because I respect where they're at in life and who they are. I've never understood lying to children. I think that you don't have to be brutal in the language or the tone of voice that you use. But I'm a fan of death literacy. I will use the words dead, death, dying, died to children as I would to adults. I think it's important to give children small chunks of information, because in my experience, children will take as much on board as they're comfortable with or need at that point in time to figure out whatever it is they're thinking about. And then when they want more information, they will come back to you.
Right.
They will either ask outright or they will start to tell you a story or start to review the conversation. And that's a signal that, okay, well, they're ready for a bit more information. Listen to them, find out what it is they're asking, what they would like to know. Be as honest as you can be, and also give them choices. I think it's a very bad idea to not let children go to celebrations of life or to funerals or to memorial services.
I do too, because, you know, it is a part of it. You know, I learned about sex by watching our poodles. Mm-hmm. I was like, well, I said, Mommy, what are they doing? They're stuck. She says, well, it's about time we have that conversation. And I got to see her deliver the babies and her nurse the children. And then about 2 years later, they were stuck again. So let's talk about the person that spontaneously dies. I mean, mm-hmm. COVID has ripped the rug from up under many of us. That's yeah. just one example. But you have people that are, and someone gave me a beautiful way of saying this. It's not, what did she say? They didn't die. No, their choice was not suicide. It was death by suicide.
So yes.
How you have to phrase that, because they're not choosing suicide. They're choosing to end the pain.
Yes. But that's actually a lovely nuance. I work very hard here in Australia to battle, again, death literacy, to battle the idea of committing suicide. Mm-hmm. Suicide has not right. been a criminal act for decades. And all that does is leave the people whose lives have been touched by a suicide death with unnecessary shame and guilt and worry that what else didn't I do? What could right. I have done more of?
Right.
Suicide deaths, I think, are in some ways the hardest to come to terms with, because the what ifs, the questions are bigger and frequently more persistent.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I'm pleased to see and hear that we're talking more openly about suicide, and we're more sane, I think, in our language and also in our understanding that if your choice is, I'm going to end the pain or I'm going to keep living in it, that's not a choice I'd wish on anyone. Mm-mm. I use a lot of clinical EFT or tapping to support people who have, who have been.
Really?
Yeah, who's girl, been affected by suicide.
I am a tapper. the first time my husband was going, he says, baby, you know, do you need some Benadryl for that? And I said, what are you talking about? He goes, well, I see you doing it. What are you doing? You know, and I had to turn him on to it. I had to turn
Absolutely.
Him on to it.
And what I love about using EFT in my therapy work is when something is really big and really overwhelming, and often if you've been very close to someone who has suicided, you don't want to talk about it or you can't talk about it. And so the tapping helps people turn the volume down, which I think is very helpful, but they don't have to keep digging the groove in their brain by talking about their feelings or their experience again and again and again. I think that we could do better as a society in terms of supporting people who are A, perhaps considering suicide, and B, who live with a disenfranchised grief, the grief that's really hard to talk about, because someone has suicided, and we don't want the blame and the accusation to shift to us because it wouldn't have happened if we'd been a better person.
Right. And you know what? I'm telling you, I'm looking at the suicides, the young woman, the young beauty queen.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you don't know what is going on in people's brains. And if people don't communicate, if they don't open up, you'll never know. And you'll always have that question of why and what if. But my suggestion, I'm not a grief recovery specialist, but is to focus on what good you did do, the conversations you did have, the love that you did share, those great moments. You can't control other people's thought patterns. And if they were, you know, 100%, they would seek out help. And sometimes, you know, I had a friend, real quick, I love to tell my stories. Guy that, you know, grew up with, I'm looking on the internet, I see this news clip, he done stripped butt naked, had a cute little butt, on a Southwest Airlines flight. They had to divert the flight so that they could get him off the plane. He was on military, and they were giving him medication, but they gave him medication that was an injectable, so he'd only have to get it every 3 months. So it was hard for him to regulate it. It got worse, and his brother found him hanging in their garage. He committed, you know, well, he died by
his own hand.
Right. And you would have never thought that, you know, mental illness is a tough one. There are some cultures also, though, that look at suicide as honorable.
Yes.
You know? So it's a lot. There's a lot of rituals that go on around suicide. But the work that you have done and that you dedicated to, why is it fulfilling to you? I mean, what does it do when you see, you know, a family get through this process? I just got a letter in the mail the other day from my mother hasn't been past a year. But the hospice team sends me a letter every month around the time of, and I thought it was just so sweet. You know, it's just so sweet. So what's your why? Why are you continuing to do this?
Because I actually enjoy empowering people. Mm. My aim with everyone I work with, whether it's planning or creating a legacy or memorial project or grief support, whatever it is, students who train with me, I aim to put myself out of business. When I've done my job right, you are feeling skilled enough, resilient enough, and confident enough in your own capacities to move forward without needing me as a crutch or I can't do this without you. The faster and more completely I can do that, the more effectively I've done my job. I actually like helping people. I enjoy solving problems. I'm pretty good at pattern recognition in emerging situations, and frequently, especially when grief is either very fresh and raw or recently re-triggered. So I do work with a lot of people who have historical childhood trauma, often from sexual assaults or abuse, well, other kinds of abuse. Let me amend that. Mm-hmm. There will be rapid changes, and there may be a lot of unconscious and unspoken stuff going on. And one of my strengths is being able to see that happening. I don't need to know the details, but we can nip it in the bud so it doesn't become yet another aspect of your grief or your own therapy and recovery that needs extensive support. We can just address it and you can get on living a happier, fuller life. And I think that's wonderful. I really enjoy that aspect of it.
Well, I had another guest on my show and she's a real heavy hitter. She goes in and talks to families after these mass casualties.
Mm-hmm. I have actually been able to speak to a mass shooting support specialist who was over in Australia for a conference.
And you know, Australia, I don't get a lot of your news. That's the first thing I do though when I do travel, is the first morning I sit there and watch the news because I want to see if you're creating the news, sensationalizing the news, or delivering me the news so I can process. Well, that's what it's become, you know, with all of these pundits and all this other stuff. But these mass shootings, and I don't know what anyone could say when a child shoots up a school and kills their colleagues, or a postal worker is mad because he's got to get a vaccination. And he goes in. I don't even know what that conversation is like when you, you know, pack your kid up and put their Twinkies in their bag and hug and kiss them, put them on the school bus. Yep. And then something like this happens. How do they begin to process? I mean, you know, the person that I had previously said, you just have to hold space and just listen.
Yes. I think it's important to recognize that just as there are waves and phases with grief, there are waves and phases in approach. So I never expect to see someone more than a couple of times if I'm in a triage position. Because the mental health and the emotional support is actually quite similar to the process of coming in with deep trauma to our physical body, to a hospital system. So there's assessment and triage, and as much patching up as you can. There may be some surgical and pharmaceutical-based support, which is a good thing, because that can help save lives and save a lot of work down the track. Mm-hmm. And then there will be ongoing support, rehabilitation, checking in. And my perspective is, and I'm frequently working in this final stage, mm-hmm. although with death, sometimes I could be in triage in the surgical aspect, or as well as the third. I do want to go on record as saying I'm a psychotherapist. I am not a psychologist or psychiatrist, so I have nothing to do with the medical and pharmaceutical side, but I understand enough to be able to support people.
And you've been around the block. I don't have a P. I got a ghetto PhD. And I know how to get people through it. It's a trust factor. You know, you have to know, you have to pass the sniff test. It's the know, like, and trust.
Yep. And if you don't like me, I will help you find someone. I'm an avid networker, and I know I'm not everybody's. Wouldn't it be great if I was everybody's best solution? That's not how it works.
They would be so lucky.
But I can certainly help network and find someone who's a really good
person. Right.
I'd like to see more of that rather than maybe the ego of, oh, I can do it all. I mean, I can do a lot and I know a lot, but I'm not everybody's best fit, and that's okay. Right.
Okay, so let's talk about the person with the PTSD, mm-hmm. post-traumatic stress disorder.
Yes.
Another story. I was working at the military base in the cosmetics department. Young man came in, and he had come back from Iraq, and he went into a transformation right in front of my eyes. I locked myself in the storeroom. I was so scared. He started to sweat. His mouth started to drool. He started to tremor. He kept hearing and reliving whatever he had experienced over and over again. And it all started with the sound of the overhead PA system. That was the same warning sign, this beep, 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 that they heard when the bombs went off, or when they had to put on their helmets, or they had to get in the tank. You know, dealing with that kind of grief and that kind of trauma is also, I don't know how people get beyond it. There's people that say, and again, you know, from your expertise, there's people that say, well, you don't have to relive that trauma, and it goes away. Aneta, I can't see it ever going away. You can process it. You can deal with it. You can learn to live with it. But I don't ever see it going away.
I agree. And in fact, I sometimes have to take a very deep breath and not express anger at the people who say, oh, you just build a bridge and get over it.
Right.
You know, buy a bag of concrete and harden up. No, my personal approach is that everything that's happened stays happened. Time is an arrow. It moves in one direction. Mm. When the arrow's passed, okay, that's what happened. This is why the what if game, while it may be very seductive for grief, it's not helpful because you're just eternally speculating. What I do think we can do, though, and what I strive for with my clients, is to turn the volume down. So it's not immediately the first thing and the only thing that you hear. In terms of brain function and the story that you told of this poor young man who was immediately back somewhere else, that
he was triggered
for him. Yeah, absolutely triggered. Is there's sort of in a trauma brain, there's a superhighway where you go from the trigger back to the event and it's super fast. Mm-hmm. I like to try and cultivate country lanes and highways and byways and work to turn the volume down by reminding people that that still happened. You can still go there if you really want to, but you don't have to take the superhighway and be immersed.
Okay.
So tapping's really helpful for that. I do have a range of different approaches, including art therapy.
Yeah, I was going to ask you the different modalities. Are you using some psychotherapy? Hypnotherapy.
No.
Okay. Mm-mm. Really?
I'm not a hypnotherapist. Mind you, in my office space, there's a nice little community of about 10 offices. There's hypnotherapists literally right behind me.
Mm. Yeah, so I can, you know, again, people incorporate different things. They sound therapy. Recall therapy. Now that's something that I use if I'm taking a test or if I'm studying. I will, you know, I have a little concoction that I'm very into aromatherapy, and mm-hmm. I will inhale it, process, do whatever I need to do. And then when I go to do whatever it is I'm going to do, take a test or whatever, I use that same concoction, inhale it, and it creates that. But that's the same thing with trauma. You know, people, a certain smell, or a certain fragrance that a person passed away with, or you look at your dog's little chewy toy that they already have. People, let's talk a little bit about grief and animals. Brains, you got to take that serious. My dog was kidnapped. You know, the coyotes jumped over the fence and ate him, and he wasn't nothing but a snack. Anyway, I am devastated. I had a animal intuitive, and she told me that he's fine, and he thanked me for 13 years. And when she said 13, I knew she was telling the truth. But your pet, that's unconditional. I remember my goldfish died, and we flushed him down the toilet and had a little service for him. Pets are so important in people's lives. Your pet, in a lot of cases, is more meaningful to you than your spouse, if your spouse is not acting right.
I love to tell people I'm fond of my husband, but I love my dog.
I know. How do people get through that? Because people are quick to say, oh, you can go to the animal shelter. You can't reenact that type of love. That's a bond that you've built.
I would suggest that when you're ready, you can choose to go to the shelter and get another pet. And some people are ready straight away and some aren't. I don't think it's very helpful when someone is talking about their grief or really experiencing their grief, because that's the kind of band-aid that is just about making the other person feel better. I'm uncomfortable, stop it. Brené Brown talks about this beautifully. She really nails it. But the grief we feel for our pets, and there's an interesting body of research that's actually coming out over the last decade or so into people and their relationship with pets, is that we can have a more profound and deeper sense of loss when our pets die than we do when many humans in our lives die. And actually, April, I have a colleague who's working on her PhD right now, and she's looking at the relationships that people create and sustain with their pets after they die. So I'll let you know when that comes out. Yes. Yes.
Well, let me know, because I got her cremated, and the other dog that I had her cremated. And it's funny because I feel her spirit. She asks me all the time, why are you always talking about Pierre and you don't talk about me? Her name was Oni. And I told her, because you died graciously of old age and he was kidnapped. I said, it's a different level, but grief, there's other types of grief. There's a loss of relationship, a loss of a job, a loss of a finance, a loss of self-esteem and self-worth. What are some of the techniques that you use with those type of grief situations?
Well, it's kind of a piece of string question. It's a good question. And my answer would be, it actually depends on the person I'm working with at the time, mm-hmm. because everybody's mm-hmm. needs and responses are different. Mm-hmm. So while my work is always person-centered, I'm not going to take a technique and say, here, I'm just going to smash this technique over your head and we'll cut off the bits at the side that don't fit. I don't like to do that. I tend to pull on a fairly extensive and varied set of skills. Everything from traditional Chinese medicine and the meridian system through to an understanding of CBT and tapping. And CBT is not my go-to, but everybody has slightly different needs. And I would work with someone with their consent and checking in constantly about their comfort and their feeling of willingness. Are they willing to do this because they feel ready? Or are they willing to do it because they think they need to please me? So if it's pleasing me, we try something else. And I'll often bring in a variety of different things. So I am a whip cracking practitioner. You frequently get some home practice with me.
Oh boy.
I try not to say home work because that's a bit scary.
Right.
And
I don't know, your partner might dig it. You never know.
We never know.
You never know.
I do also try very hard not to fall into a rut of, well, we did this last week, so we'll do this again. It's right. It's constantly me being awake, being present, checking in, making sure there's consent, making sure that my client's comfortable and that we're moving in the right direction.
I like how you use the word consent, because you're asking permission to enter into this person's space, their head space, their heart space, you know? So let's talk about what you said about sexual energy and that dying. What did you mean by that?
Okay. I was coming from a perspective of being someone who sometimes works with people pre-need. So there's no terminal or life-limiting diagnosis in place. And as an end-of-life doula, end-of-life consultant, support person, therapist, planner, end of life for some of us is super fast. Sometimes it's weeks or months, but for some of us, it's years. It depends on actually our own personality and physiology, as well as the diagnosis that we have and our quality of life. So something that might generally in the medical community say, well, generally it's going to be 2 to 3 years. It might be 8 months, or it might be 5 years. So during that end of life period, your actual physical abilities may change. You may go from full ambulation to being in a wheelchair or needing walking aids. You may or may not have fine motor control. You may not have stamina to be, if you're used to being the dominant partner, for example, and on top in sexual situations, you may need to modify to be on your side and playing around with different positions. I'm a sex positive end of life consultant. Mm. And I think that sensuality and sexuality and intimacy are so important to a good quality of life. Yeah. And unfortunately, receiving a diagnosis often means, well, everything's switched off and now you are just your diagnosis. Off you go into the corner. You won't enjoy food anymore. You won't enjoy or feel sex or love anymore. You don't need any quality of life. So I think it's important to address that. Well, did you know, for example, being in a wheelchair and you've got a standard bed, you're perfectly positioned for oral sex without too much strain and stress on yourself.
Right.
That's great. Have you thought about trying that rather than maybe other things that you were used to?
Right.
So it's that process of being, I like to say, fiercely alive until we're dead, as fully and completely as possible. And
I got another story.
Yay.
Okay. So you're a planner. Mm-hmm. I like that. I was working in the same cosmetic department that the young man had his PTSD episode. Customer comes in, absolutely adored me. I would sit her in my chair and she says, April, I came to see you. Can you make me pretty? And I said, okay. And she started pouring her heart out to me. Yeah, I felt like her therapist. Well, long story short, she was dying. She had, you know, her body had been butchered because she had a lot of cancer, and her husband was stepping out on her. And so she says, what do I do? And I had a conversation with her. I couldn't believe it. I told her, well, you have to really realize that his life still continues. And are you willing to allow him, as long as there, you know, whatever your boundary, whatever framework it is, but are you big enough and are you mature enough and are you self-confident enough and are you willing to free him from the bondage? Because he, you know, he's not going to die with you. What are you able to do? And, you know, she came back to me about 3 or 4 weeks later, and she said that, you know, they had a conversation. What that was, I didn't want to get all into it, but she looked a whole lot better. So maybe she's allowed something, you know, to happen in their relationship, allowed him to do what he was doing without having to sneak and hide. But you have to understand that if you're dying or transitioning, that other person is not going with you. What do you, you know, how do you want to prepare that? If you've got a cool relationship, you know, do you want your person to feel comfortable dating again or having another relationship? You know, that's a part of the conversation as well. That's freeing to the other individual. Oh, you know, I can't do that. You know, I can't clean out the closet because, you know, his clothes were there and they still smell like him and all, you know, being stuck in these positions can be very difficult.
Yes. And I'm genuinely sorry that your customer that you had these wonderful conversations with didn't have someone who came and had the conversation before he started stepping out on her. It would have been great and ideal, I think, had he sat down and said, I'm still feeling a very high libido. I still have sexual needs and urges. How would it be if, and there are different options. So you've got sex workers who perform wonderful, wonderful services. You know, you're getting somebody who is
a trained professional.
That's right, a trained professional. You've got someone who takes sexual health seriously. You've got someone who's not going to start texting in the middle of the night or overstepping boundaries and impinging on the marriage. So sex workers can be wonderful both before a death but also after a death in terms of rediscovering what sex feels like with a different person.
Right, because people don't do that. They feel that it's off limits now. I can never have sexual pleasure with anyone else because my spouse died. You know, that's hard for them too.
Actually, there's weird pressures, especially on women from that direction, and a lot of judgment. It's only been a year or 5 years. If you feel sexual a week after your spouse or partner dies and you want to act on that, you're an adult. That's nobody else's business. Mm. Men, on the other hand, frequently get pressure from the other direction, and it's hard to talk about because men are always supposed to be up for it, right?
Right.
And people, oh, get back on the saddle, get back out there. And they might want some more time.
Mm.
So we have interesting gender-based weird ideas about getting involved in other people's bedrooms, other people's knickers. We need to stay out and let people have their own process. Because again, that's going to be deeply personal. The other thing that might, the other part of the conversation might be, maybe there is already somebody in the orbit of the spouse and or spouses who there may be an attraction. And if that can be boundaried and it's consensual all around, maybe that becomes part of the routine and the consolation. Well, and in fact, part of the end of life. It's different for every.
It is. I had a conversation with a girlfriend the other day, and she was telling me, you know, we had a mutual friend. The friend died, and now the husband is pushing up on her. And she says, oh, no, but I knew his wife, but his wife is dead.
Yeah, she actually doesn't care. Spoiler alert. She doesn't care.
You know, she doesn't care. But what I think it is, forgive me if I'm wrong, but I think that she has a certain guilt about what other people are going to say. Because I heard other things in her voice. Well, he's got a nice this, and he's a good looking guy, and he's this, and he's that. But I can't do that because I'm not that kind of person. What is that kind of person?
Yeah, who's so,
now? Who's and I say that. I say that kind of snarkily because I've been married 37 years, and if one of my girlfriends got with Mr. Magnificent, I'd haunt that bitch. I would. I'd come up out the ground on her. So it's easy for me to say if I'm not in that situation. But at, you know, at this particular juncture, I'm saying, well, give it some time. You may like it. People move towards the familiar. They move to where they're comfortable. I know this person. I have a conversation with this person. I've always kind of liked conversations that I've had with them, maybe going out to dinner. That doesn't mean that they're going to marry you. That doesn't mean that they want to bump uglies right away. Sometimes they just want conversation and camaraderie around someone that is familiar, that makes them feel comfortable.
And also a safe space to talk about your dead spouse.
Right, right.
Because you have a history to, and it's not going to be, oh, tell me everything because I'm ghoulish, or oh, I couldn't talk about that, that's weird. When there's already been a long relationship that's a natural part of your dynamic,
right,
it can be really comforting because there's probably not going to be platitudes. There's probably not going to be, oh, I'm uncomfortable, talk about something else, or la, 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 I don't want to know. It's simply, yeah, do you remember when they love this time of day? And we'd always have a glass of wine at this time and talk about how beautiful the sky was.
Exactly. Yeah.
And so actually you're recreating that, and you maybe open a window where, well, we've given each other permission to keep doing that because that's a really nice part of
Absolutely.
Who that person was.
Absolutely.
So I would suggest that this person needs permission to not have other people's voices in her head.
Well, yeah, that's what I said.
I think she's
worried about, you know, and again, she may not be interested. I don't know. But I think that she's worried about what the naysayers are going to say. Girl, you know, couldn't wait. The body wasn't even cold in the grave. And here she is. She's, you know, driving around in his Lexus. You know how people like to do that. But if you're not mature enough to handle it and handle what those conversations are, then you're not ready for that. And you do the other person a disservice if you're, you know, if you're with them and it's very disingenuous, because they can tell, and that's going to hurt them even more.
And I would also quietly point out, none of us know how much time we have. The great idea of if I die and when I retire, it's
right.
Actually the other way. If I retire and when I die, because that is the universal human experience. Mm-hmm. Not all of us are born, but all of us will die. Grab life with both hands if it feels right to you. And let's work on being more death literate as a community and a lot less judgy and stay out of other people's business.
Right. And your paperwork in order, brains, you know, that... It makes such a difference. People are not arguing and fighting over, because if you love your family, you will make provisions for them. If they're stepchildren, you want, you know, your children to be taken care of. You don't want it to end up in probate. That just makes the grieving process even worse. And there's always, I'm gonna tell you, brains, I probably don't have to tell you, every time somebody dies, somebody shows up and shows out where you least expect it. So what I did when that happened to me is I stepped back and I allowed them to do whatever little trickery that they wanted to do. I let them go through, because that's their grieving process. They're not going to grieve like I'm going to grieve. I was taking the high road. I was not going to let anything distract me from the beauty of watching the transition of my mother, knowing that she was safe, that she was here with me. I wasn't going to let anybody damage that. But people will leave you out of the obituary. They will not allow you at the funeral. They will, you know, drag you into court. And is it really worth it? Is it really worth it? It's ugly. Let's talk about some joy, though. What in the world do you do that just makes you happy? What lights you up?
I spend time with my dog.
Really?
Yep. So I love just going out and sitting on the grass in the shade with the breeze, and we'll play with a squeaky toy. And even if we just do that for 10 minutes, he's so happy because that's his happy place. He loves to go swimming. So at the moment where I am, it's summertime, and we go to the local lake and we swim, and he gets to bark a lot because he's half Malamute. So he's a good communicator and barks to have the ball thrown, and we have fun there. I knit. I write. Really?
Yes. Knitting is coming back. Knitting and crocheting and needlework. I think we talked about that. It is coming back with a vengeance.
And it's fantastic for lowering blood pressure, mindfulness. If I'm really perturbed or upset or very tired, I will do very plain, straight knitting that I don't have to think about. If I have the luxury and happiness of a chunk of time for me and I'm into it, I'll do lace work, which is more complex. So I have several projects so I can choose. I love to read. I enjoy gardening. I prefer red wine to white, but I'm always up for bubbles. And I actually, my happy place is a few people, and it might just be my husband and I or a couple of good friends with us, and we can have a really good conversation. I'm not a big party person. I love that that's an option, and that
works. I don't know. COVID did that to me. I'm a social butterfly because, you know, I'm into that going out, but I could do without it. I love being home with just me and Mr. Magnificent and, you know, whatever it is, bubbly, my bubbly could be beer.
I love the way that you call him that, Mr. Magnificent.
He is. I mean, I love the breeze that keeps him cool. I do, because he allows himself to love me wherever I am. Now we got to reel it in. There's no fear. There's no intimidation. Never has been. There's no permission. There's support. You know, he says no, but just the love and just the tenderness, you know, we're in the grocery store. I can hear him clear his throat and oh my God, my sexual charge goes from 0 to 10. And it's just a great place. But with that, someone has told me that we were soulmates in a previous life. And so many times you see when couples have been married, we've been married, like I said, 37 years, when the one spouse dies shortly after, the other one joins them. What is that synchronicity? Where does that come from, you think?
Oh, gosh. That's a really interesting question. And I'm going to be honest and say, I don't know. It may simply be that, especially when there's been a longer period of time, mm-hmm. and you're really attuned to each other's smells and each other's biorhythms. And it sounds like you and Mr. Magnificent have a fabulous marriage. I'm not going to say perfect because I don't think, you know, perfection. Yeah, no, but it sounds wonderful and I'm thrilled for you. But when you have that and you have someone to share everything with, and that is your enough, why would you want to go on with less than enough? Now, some people do, and that's fine. But I maybe it's simply because it's no longer enough. It's no longer complete. And this just isn't enough.
You know, I've had situations. I've had situations with a couple of my friends that were relieved when the person died, the other mm-hmm. person died, because of the torment and the torture and the pain and the abuse that they experienced. But having that experience ended up backfiring on them because now they feel guilt and shame that they have relished in the death of another individual. So they've got a lot of stuff bouncing around in their head, you know? And it's real difficult to see that.
I think guilt at death can show up at really odd times, and sometimes it's really fast. So it's not uncommon for someone who's been a primary carer, or just even if there's lots of support and you're not the only one doing intensive care, going to the hospital is exhausting, or just running extra errands and putting the emotional energy into holding space for someone who's dying is exhausting. And so, you know, a parent will die or a sibling will die, and it's like, oh my God, I got my gym schedule back. And it's such right. a relief. And then immediately, rather than just saying, oh, this is a perfectly normal response because my life can kind of go back
right.
to the way I like it, is the, oh shit, I'm a bad person.
Right.
Because I shouldn't be, I should just be wallowing in the grief. And we Velcro our wrists to our forehead.
Right.
And
right.
we forget that part of grief is suddenly laughing out loud in the middle of the grocery store because you remember the joke that you used to make about the brand of cookies that you like to buy with your best friend who just died. Or you throw back your head and you roll your eyes and go, of course, when you forget to fill up the windscreen wiper.
Exactly.
And your brother always told you, make sure that your windscreen wiper liquid is topped up. You know, whatever the little things are. So in life, we have highs and lows and then middle bits. It's all over the place. The afters of a death, all of the waves and presentations and experiences of grief are going to have some highs and some lows and some middle bits. It'll change, and it's going to be different for every single person whose death you survive, because your relationship with all of those people was different. Mm-hmm. So we can't say, oh, well, looking at our watch, when my mother died, I did this and this and this. So when my father dies, it will. No, again, spoiler alert, it's going to be completely different. Some there's of it will feel similar, but there will be differences.
There's two things that kind of happened to me. When my mother, when she passed away, it was, I was on a routine. I had a schedule. You know, mm-hmm. certain time I give her medication. Other times I feed her lunch. Then I give her a bath. Then I tuck her in. We always said our prayers together. So when she passed away, I decided to fill those same time slots with things that I enjoyed. You know, I would work out during the time that I would feed her lunch. I make that my reading time. When we would say our prayers together, now I say my prayers at night with Mr. Magnificent. Her spirit told me too. I said, Mama, I said, since you've been gone, I haven't been saying your prayers, my prayers. She said, you better, because I want to see you again. You know? And I do believe that, and I know that she has shared that with me.
She waved a finger at you.
Exactly. So fill those empty spaces with me time. And it's up to you. But I wasn't going to feel guilty, because there were days that I was exhausted. There were times that I looked at her and she looked at me and she knew I was exhausted, but I was the only resource that she had. So I didn't have to feel guilty when she actually passed away. And I was like, it's okay to take that deep breath. It is really okay.
It's healthy to take that deep breath.
You know, and you owe that to yourself. Caregivers, get a rest break. You can't do it 24/7, because if you deplete yourself, then you're no good to anybody.
That's right. We have to be nourished and we have to be full. And having a compassionate community of people that can help support us as well as the person who's at end of life.
It's incredible. Well, you have been such a blessing here on the edge in so many ways. And I thank you. You know, God gives angel wings to special people, grief recovery specialists, hospice workers, nurses, teachers are my favorite people on the planet. So never, ever think that your work is in vain or that you are not appreciated, because you are. You could do any other thing, you know, but you opt to work with individuals to get them through a point of pain that they can realize and know that life still goes on. The other thing that just kind of sits with me is that I look at a picture of a photograph and I'm the only damn person left living in it. My mother's gone. My father's gone. My brothers are gone. My dog was gone. So now I'm looking at my mortality and I'm like, I'm next. And I take that seriously. So I'm going to try to live the best life that I possibly can, be as giving as I can, not be afraid. You know, COVID, yeah, I'm scared like everybody else, but I've had my come to Jesus meeting. And if this is how I go out, at least I've ticked the boxes. Live your life, brains. Live your life. That's all we can say. Tell them, Annetta, how to get in contact with you. I'd love for them to work with you. Oh, I wish you were here. Girl, we would have the best time. You have to come to San Diego, come to the States. It's a lot like Sydney where I live.
It's very much like Sydney.
That's right, because you were here in San Diego.
I lived in San Diego for 4.5 years.
Then you better come on back.
All right. It may not be 2022, but maybe 2023. I will let you know. You're on. All right. I work face-to-face here in Tasmania, but I do an awful lot of work with Australian and international clients. You can look me up. My business name is Gentle Death Education and Planning, gdep.com.au. And I have a contact form on my website. My email address is info@gdep.com.au. And I can work on a phone or audio call, but I'm very comfortable working on Zoom with people. So distance is not an issue for me.
Well, brains, fill up that space in the most positive way, in the most delightful way. Look at that smile. Then that just makes you comfortable within itself. I need you brains to go in to this location right here. I need you to like, love, and share this information. Share with the person that has gone through it, going through it, or even do a self-evaluation, because we're all going to get there. Death is guaranteed. And you know what? I believe that we have a buy-in. I believe that we have a process, that we have choices, that we have options. And we want it to be as pleasant, as peaceful as possibly can. So thank you, Annetta. You are the queen of everything.
Thank you, April. It's been a pleasure. I'm so pleased that I got to do this.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You have to come back, and next time we'll talk about cooking.
You're on. I love to cook.
Okay. All right. Bye, brains. Get it together. Get your paperwork and stuff in order.
Bye.